hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the right side of me. Yeah, walking on the right side of me. Running down the wheel line, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a falling down key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the end of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, excuse me, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Here's an interesting one. Canadian academic indulging in a little more denial. Now, that's, of course, okay. There's actually a communist, a member of the Canadian Communist Party, I'm going to say about 25 years ago, who argued that the revelations made by a number of writers, but including, I guess it was popularized in English by Robert Conquest, about Stalin's famine. And that was the deliberate effort in 1932-33 to destroy the Ukrainian peasantry, or to restate, or perhaps we should rephrase that, to destroy resistance by the Ukrainian peasantry to communism, or to the collectivization of their farms. And what they simply did is they gathered up all the food, all the seed, all the animals, and left rural Ukrainians basically to starve. Some even resorted to cannibalism, and the estimates run from 8 to 10 million the people who were ruthlessly, on the basis of their ethnicity, starved to death. Now, I'm sure you have heard about this, so I won't say, well, I guess, yeah, but this is one of the things you've never heard of. You probably heard about it. But my gosh, is there a docudrama about this every other week on CBC or CNN or ABC? Of course not. Is there a dramatization of it? Are survivors oiling their way around high schools? Now, of course, there would be hardly anybody alive today who could honestly claim to be a survivor. Well, there weren't very many survivors. This is, I hate to use the word Holocaust, because that actually means a burnt offering. There was really probably nothing burned there. Except perhaps in some cases, food on these people's farms. But this was cold-blooded mass murder, and one of the great outrages of the political elite we have today is that this is, if not outright denied, and that it is hard, you don't find a lot of deniers except on the very far left anymore. It's certainly downplayed. The sufferings of people in Europe, in the period from 1918 to 1945. Of course, 1 million German civilians were deliberately starved to death, deliberately, by the Allies Allied blockade after, not before, not during war, but after November 11th, 1918, the armistice. Armistice means you stop fighting. Well, the guns stopped, but the Allies continued a blockade of Germany, basically to break its resistance, to force the political leadership after the Kaiser abdicated into signing the outrageous terms of the Versailles Accord, where basically Germany assumed all the guilt for World War I. They had to agree that they hadn't caused it. At most, they were one of the factors. And I won't rehearse the what led to what, but it's noteworthy that, as in the Second World War, England, London and Paris declared war on Berlin, not the other way around. But anyway, there are millions of civilians starved there. After World War II, in the greatest expulsion, in the greatest ethnic cleansing in all of human history, 16 million ethnic Germans were deported. Right, I mean, just forced out at gunpoint. From their ancestral homelands in Ostpreussen or East Prussia, in West Prussia, in Memelland, in Silesia, in the Sudetenland, in the lands of the Danube Swabians, that's what used to be northern Yugoslavia and western Romania. 3 million murdered or died along the way. Well, that ought to count for something. 1 million surrendered German soldiers deliberately starved to death, or allowed to die of exposure and disease. And don't forget, they surrendered. It's after the war, in Eisenhower's death camps along the Rhine, 1945 to 46. Another million German civilians starved to death in Germany after the war. It was not at this point, because there was huge disruption of communications. While there was damage from the war, it wasn't as if the food wasn't there. Food had been raised from Canada and other places. It was being distributed by the former U.S. President Herbert Hoover, a great humanitarian. But the entry of the distribution of this food was denied, or largely denied, by elements within the Allies. Another million German civilians starved to death. Oh yes, but did you hear about the 6 million? And then, of course, perhaps the biggest figure of them all, the 8 to 10 million Ukrainians deliberately starved to death in 1932-33. So when the history of the, let's say, the first half of the 20th century is told, almost all you will hear in popular histories and in academia is about the 6 million. The alleged 6 million, because that figure just doesn't hold up. 6 million. And that's, of course, held not just at Germany. It's a figure that's used to induce undeserved guilt. But it's also, because of this new religion of Holocaust, used to implicate us all. You know, it's our fault. Wait a sec. We didn't do it, whatever it was. It didn't happen to Canadians, and it didn't happen in Canada. So how's it our fault that we fought the guys who supposedly did do it? We're the good guys. No. We're all bad. Anyway, in order to have a balanced, and therefore a view that's not hobbled by phony guilt, it's important to keep a hold of the facts. So this seems to be a long meander from where I started, but Canadian academic indulging in Holodomor denial. And here's a memorial, a symbolic sheaves of wheat and light candles during a commemoration ceremony of a monument to those who died in the Holodomor 1932 to 1933, and this was in Kiev on November 23rd of this year. This was the memorial. Anyway, the raw numbers are appalling enough. During Joseph Stalin's deliberate starvation of the Ukraine in 1932 and 33, nearly 10 million people died. As many as 6 million more were born to malnourished parents and suffered severe, often deadly birth effects. In all, at least 13% of the population of the Ukraine was murdered in 18 months through Stalin's attempt to force collectivization on private farms and terrorize the independence movement in the Ukraine. But as awful as the statistics are, the personal stories are worse. American researchers in the 1980s collected case histories from hundreds of survivors and combed through the diaries of hundreds more who had died. One common memory was the way people simply dropped dead in the streets. They were so weak from starvation, they could not take another step. Even before they died, their emaciated bodies began to swell and reek from lack of nutrition. It's a phenomenon you sometimes hear from today's relief workers who assist during famines around the world. Stalin's secret police and army first came and confiscated all the grain. Ukraine's rich soil is among the best in the world for growing wheat and other crops. In fact, that's one of the reasons Canada recruited Ukrainian farmers to open up the prairies just before the First World War. Stalin wanted the Ukrainian harvest to feed his troops and the workers in his state-owned factories. He was also keen to punish the Ukraine, which was developing a solid agricultural middle class, the kulaks, as the communists derisively named them, who wanted to be free from Soviet tyranny. When stealing all the crops failed to break Ukraine's spirit, Stalin sent his secret security services into homes to remove everything edible from cupboards, pantries, and cellars. Desperate people began digging up frozen potatoes from the ground at abandoned farms and were often shot for this crime against the state. In her compelling 2017 book, Red Famine, author Anne Applebaum recalls how some peasants even buried their children before they were dead, rather than be forced to watch them die slowly from lack of food. Those who didn't wither away and die in the street, those fortunate enough to make it to the hospital, died anyway. Hospitals had no food and little medicine, thanks to Uncle Joe, that's of course Stalin. Most of those victims were buried in mass graves. Enter Dougal MacDonald, an assistant lecturer in elementary education at the University of Alberta, and an avowed communist. That's it, as a member of the Communist Party. Now, this is not an accusation tossed at him by others. While the Holodomor was little known in the West before the 1980s, and the scale of it often doubted even after the genocide was revealed, there's now plenty of scholarly evidence that the Holodomor was very real and every bit as horrific as survivors claim. Denying the Holodomor is on an intellectual and moral plane with denying the Holocaust. Earlier this month, however, MacDonald, who ran as the Marxist-Leninist candidate in an Edmonton riding during the 2015 and 2019 election, actually, so that would make him a member of the Communist Party of Canada, Marxist-Leninists, who were the Maoists. They're now, well, then they followed Enver Hoxha, for God's sake. He was the, after Mao died, he was the president of Romania, of Albania, a country so impoverished by communism that its major export is human hair. Anyway, back to MacDonald. He said on Facebook, the tales of the Holodomor famine were a myth and a lie. They were phony stories started by the Nazis to discredit Stalin and communism. Well, Stalin's incompetence and the incompetence and unproductiveness of communism discredited itself. Had MacDonald offered historical research to back his claims, documents he'd uncovered, for instance, academic freedom might apply, even if his work was controversial, although it's very difficult to ignore his inflammatory language. But MacDonald didn't make a scholarly argument. He simply repeated the Communist Party propaganda, every bit as old and as imagined, he was making a lazy ideological statement. I'm sick and tired of opponents demanding everyone that they disagree with or make controversial remarks be fired. But does the University of Alberta truly want to be associated with a Holodomor denier when MacDonald's lecturer's contract expires? The U of Alberta should not renew it. I think this is a very interesting article and is perhaps an extreme example. Oh, this was actually written by Lauren Gunter as a column in the Toronto Sun of Saturday. Now, the the accusation that there's communist influence in universities, a lot of communist influence, is an accusation well placed. However, extreme this one person may be, it is a reality. The cultural Marxists certainly dominate many university departments, particularly in the arts. And that's one of the reasons so much of what comes out of the universities is so left and totalitarian. Here you've got a professor actively denying a fact of history. He's not just some street level nutter. Apparently he's a lecturer at the University of Alberta. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Yeah, every now and again I pick up. excuse me. sorry. I pick up Now magazine, which is actually not a magazine, but it is a newspaper, and it is a far leftist cultural weekly that is there's similar papers across Canada, I picked it up because I was I'd like to take a look and see what the left is saying, and it's always somewhat interesting. So anyway, here's an article by Tom Hooper, who's a historian of LGBTQ2 criminalization in Canada. He says that what I find interesting is that a lot of federal money was given this past year to the sexually weird community to celebrate a change of the law that occurred in 1969, and that was the practice of homosexuality, namely sodomy, was legalized, provided it was between two consenting adults and they were over 21. Well, eventually the age was, I believe, reduced to 18. But that, of course, was not enough. This was hardly anything worth celebrating, says Tom Hooper. And he goes on to say, the Department of Canadian Heritage doled out $2,177,193 in grants to various LGBTQ groups across the country to celebrate decriminalization. Of course, I say, and I'm sure you would too, well, wait a sec. If they want to celebrate the decriminalization of the whole practice male homosexuality, well, why must they do it on the taxpayers' dime? Let them pass the ballet slippers around or whatever, and fund it themselves. Why must the glorification of this community be done at taxpayers' expense? According to documents obtained under Access to Information, AGAL, now that's one of the major LGBTQ lobby groups in Canada, AGAL Canada Human Rights Trust received $771,240 for a traveling photo exhibit and documentary film to mark the legalization of homosexuality. Legalizing Love, The Road to June 27, 1969, that's the name of it. It was later rebranded Sex, Sin, and 69, and it premiered in Toronto in June of this year, and it was being shown at various gay pride festivals across the country. Gay Pride Toronto received a grant of $250,000 from Canadian Heritage to celebrate 1969. Why does the government give our money to this tiny community, this tiny fringe of the sexually other? I mean, they can raise the money themselves. In fact, being homosexual and not having families for the most part, I mean, not having the responsibilities of, not all, but for the most part, of a man in a family situation with a wife and children to support, they have more disposable income as a community. And I'm not denying that there might be poor homosexuals as well, but as a community, they're somewhat better off. Why should we be paying for them to celebrate? Further $450,000 was provided by the Department of Public Safety in order to help LGBTQ groups engage more with the police. And I'm not going to rehearse the rest of the arguments that this writer made. He had another point. Yeah, another point that he was trying to make, but and it's not really to our purpose to go over it. But what I did find particularly obnoxious, well, was the fact that we're paying for this. Oh yeah, while still on the the LGBTQ sexually other gang, the latest scandal to hit the poor Conservative Party of Canada, and there really is an organized effort to try to get him purged, to try to get the party leader purged. And I'm two minds about that. Andrew Scheer is a weak man, He may have some good ideas, but he's a globalist, he's weak, and he probably isn't the best leader for the party. However, those are not particularly the arguments being thrown out. The big knock against Andrew Scheer, according to the turncoats within his own party, and the endlessly nattering, chattering classes, is that he failed to march in gay pride parades, and has not said whether he will or not. He's never done it. And he failed to adequately explain himself in the last election when the Liberals, who of course are in favor of mass, I mean, they're forced to be, well, whatever an individual Liberal candidate might personally feel, they must proclaim their support, their unquestioning support, for the absolute right of a woman to exterminate her unborn child right up until the moment its little head pops out of the womb. In other words, abortion on demand as a woman's absolute right. Absolute. Now, that's a core value of the Liberal Party of Canada, which is one of the reasons I say it's become a degenerate party. Never mind its economic policies. We can argue about that. But when it becomes absolutely part of a party's policy to uphold the right to murder, absolute right, not even debatable, not even, well, I mean, maybe it could be limited. No. Absolute, it's a woman's right. What the Liberal leader, Justin Trudeau, did, and with an assist from some of the other party leaders, was to make the Conservative leader, Andrew Scheer's, personal views — he's opposed to abortion, he's made that clear — a political issue. And I don't think Scheer very adequately explained himself, but that's another matter. also, they made the fact that he is uncomfortable with LGBTQ marriage, or same-sex marriage. Well, he's not the only one. And yes, it may be the law of the land, the nine men and women against traditional rights, in other words, our Supreme Court, did in fact rule that the traditional definition of marriage, that is, a man and a woman, was discriminatory. Well, yeah, it may indeed be discriminatory, but it's common sense. It's a man and a woman, not two men, not two women, not a man and a goat. It's a man and a woman. Well, that's the law of the land. Well, it may be the law of the land, and the law of the land could be changed. Anyway, Andrew Scheer, I don't think very adequately explained himself, but that was held against him. So that's what. So what the argument is that Andrew Scheer, although he led his party to win a majority of the votes, or I should say a plurality, the Conservatives got about 250,000 votes more than the Liberals, but because of the first past the post system, the Liberals won more seats. I think they got 150. One, and the Conservatives got 126, but not enough for a majority government. And yes, certainly there's disappointment and so on. But the morality that's being held up is a real problem, or the immorality that's being promoted. Anyway, Andrew Scheer appointed as deputy leader a Liberal who had left the Liberal Party. Her name is Leona Alisev. And he appointed her deputy leader. And there are political reasons for that, which I won't go into. But, yesterday she said something that caused the media to go bananas. And, of course, Scheer's critics to leap on. What she said was she had no problems marching in gay pride parades. and she done so, and would do so again. However, Andrew Scheer has every right to his personal religious beliefs, as does everybody. And he has every right not to march in a gay pride parade, just as he has every right not to march in a St. Patrick's Day parade. Now, do you hear anything wrong there? Well, yeah, what I would disagree with, or I would be disappointed in, is that Leona Alisev would personally has marched and would march again in gay pride parades. But no, that's not what the media picked up on. What the media was horrified at was the comparison between gay pride parades and St. Patrick's Day parades. Let me say, on that, I think she's perfectly right. What does the St. Patrick's Day parade do? Well, and I don't really want to get into the partisan Catholic versus Protestant debate within Ireland. Let me say, ideally, it celebrates pride in being Irish, for all Irishmen. You know, on a more narrow level, it sometimes celebrates the pride in being Irish of the Irish Catholics. But either way, it celebrates pride in ethnicity, mostly. Yeah. Common shared history. Okay. A leader would have the right not to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade, right? Absolutely. If it's not your thing, it's not your thing. I've never marched in a St. Patrick's Day parade. I am perhaps 1/8 Irish. And it's neither a source of great... It is, for me, it's not a great issue one way or the other. but not marching in a... Well, let's say... If I had no Irish ethnicity whatsoever, why should I want to march in it? That's a good point. Okay, so we can all agree people have the right not to march in the gay pride parade, sorry, in the St. Patrick's Day parade. Well, what's the problem with comparing it to the gay pride parade? I don't know. The LGBTQ crowd claimed that... whichever of the subsets of weirdness that they identify with is part of their identity. So if you are homosexual or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered or the other queer or questioning or whatever, that this is part of this, your nature. It's not a choice you make. Okay. Well, similarly with being Irish. You don't choose to be Irish. If your last name is Yamamoto and your parents are Japanese, you can't say, well, I'm going to identify as Irish. You can't. It doesn't make you know, even if you like Irish music, you like Irish whiskey, or you like Irish beer, or you like Irish poetry, it doesn't make you Irish. Anyway, I would say they're exactly the same. And, of course, that is debatable, there are people who say nothing, that the practice of homosexuality is a moral choice. I can't choose not to be Irish. I can, if I'm homosexually inclined, choose not to bugger some guy I met in a bar. But leaving that aside, but... The two, on some levels, are comparable. They are a matter of choice. So, how is it then that she made a great mistake? Well, I don't know, but within hours she was apologizing. She hadn't meant to offend anybody, and her remarks were, you know, inappropriate. How are they inappropriate? Well. The problem it right now is that
the cultural Marxists in Canada want you to be compelled to participate in gay pride parades if you're a leader, because you must be seen to celebrate LGBTQ practice. And quite frankly, I can't see how a practicing Christian can do that. you can't. If you're a practicing Christian, how can you celebrate? And that's what the gay pride parades are. Celebrate, where they stick it during the act of sex. Now, that's not about denying anything. But why must I be compelled to celebrate it? Well, very good question. Okay. This is the latest media-induced scandal. It's like so much of what's in the mass media, it's a tempest in a teapot. Last item I'd like to take a look at is something that was put out by the Realists, and this is a very, very, came out from Natural News. It's a very important warning. The United Nations is now targeting free speech on a global scale under the banner of fighting hate speech. To most Americans, the United Nations is an innocuous organization that serves as a global forum for countries to work out their differences while providing services like disaster relief, peacekeeping, health care, and other services. In reality, the United Nations is primarily staffed by representatives from authoritarian regimes and elitists who seek to transform the organization into the central hub of a new world order and global governance. Part of that effort involves limiting the right of free speech in as many countries as possible, especially in the United States, whose constitution still serves as a model for empowering the individual over the government. Yeah, they just hate that First Amendment. In Canada, we've already abolished that with our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Sounds really good, but it's a Soviet-styled document that looks good on the surface, but doles out very stingily rights to us. Doles out rights that we already have. But anyway, that's a digression. Part of that effort involves limiting the rights to free speech in as many countries as possible. And like the left in America, the UN officials are seeking to curb free expression and free exchange of ideas by claiming to fight hate speech. Never, of course, defined. As reported by WND in July, the UN began a crackdown on sorts of hate speech, but in doing so defined the term so broadly that literally any speech could be considered to be a violation depending on who is doing the evaluating, a political analyst noted. The crackdown came in response to mostly Muslim countries that were demanding anyone who's critical of Islam be punished, according to Judith Bergman, a lawyer and senior fellow with the Gatestone Institute. Of course, Islam is a very repressive state-imposed religion. Oh yeah, kind of like the new religion of Holocaust. Yeah, anyway, a digression. While the UN attempted to assure everyone that addressing hate speech does not mean limiting or prohibiting freedom of speech, the fact is, Bergman noted, the organization's actions betrayed its words. Quote, this was evident with regard to the UN Global Compact on Migration, in which it was explicitly stated that public funding to media outlets that systematically promote intolerance, xenophobia, racism, and other forms of discrimination toward migrants should be stopped. So that's the first step. And those of us who strongly oppose signing that Global Compact on Migration, among other reasons, cited notice how vague that is. There should not be public funding to media outlets that systematically promote intolerance. Xenophobia, that's fear of strangers. Racism, or whatever that is, and for other forms of discrimination toward migrants. So supposing you say, we shouldn't be taking any more of these messed up refugees from countries who these people, many of them are psychologically badly damaged. We don't need them here. Woo-hoo-hoo! Well, that'd be xenophobia, probably. what else would it be? Maybe it's intolerance. I don't know if it's racism, maybe. And it's discrimination. It's definitely discrimination. Not toward migrants, but against. Now, it's, technically it's public funding. I don't think the government should be funding the media, but in fact, the UN's action plan against hate speech does contain a definition of what the organization considers to be hate speech. The UN has failed miserably at its founding mission, that is to prevent war. Quote, any communication in speech, writing or behavior that attacks or uses pejorative or discriminatory language with reference to a person or a group on the basis of who they are, in other words, based on their religion, ethnicity, nationality, race, color, descent, gender, or other identifying factor, the UN says, again, which is broad enough that any speech critical of any protected class of persons or religions could be considered hate speech. In a February speech to the UN Human Rights Council, Secretary General Antonio Guterres provided more clues as to what his organization considers to be hate speech. He said, the rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights belong to everyone, everywhere. They are independent of nationality, gender, sexual orientation, race, religion, belief, or any other status. It should be noted, however, that the member states have never agreed that sexual orientation is a protected category of non-discrimination. He added that he's alarmed by a groundswell of xenophobia, racism, and intolerance, including rising anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hatred. Quote, and that hate speech is a menace to democratic values, social stability, and peace. He also said hate speech spreads like wildfire through social media and internet and conspiracy theories. in fact, I think you get the picture. It's free speech. It's criticism of illegals and so on. That's the real target. And not surprising. Almost as long as I've been involved politically, groups I know, like the John Birch Society, have said, and they had a slogan back there in the 60s and 70s, get us, that's the U.S., out of the U.N. and the U.N., a nest of spies and the parasites, out of the U.S. So get the U.N. out of get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S. I think this is a good goal. I think Canada should withdraw from the United Nations and be members only of a very select number of committees that actually do something. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the funny side of me. I'm going to take my musical interlude right now. I'm going to play a song. This guy is a gifted comedian, Ray Stevens. He's written and performed so many great satirical songs over the years. This is one about the latest hoax of used to be climate change. Now, of course, it's global warming, but amounts to the same thing, right? This is. The global warming song.
Now here we have two real pioneers embarking upon a new career, capitalizing on this global warming hype. Yeah, they're the ones that brought you the left-handed hammer and tried to market a recycled pamper. You could say the Gulliver brothers have always been the entrepreneurial type. But this next harebrained gullible venture could be earmarked as the major clincher as to whether or not they'll be living it up in their retirement age. They put all they had into one bankroll, bought a bunch of land down at the South Pole, eagerly awaiting the impending doom of climate change, thereby being in the catbird seat in a new Florida. And I'm off for working hard. Keep this planet clean, but man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms. Next up on the Real Estate Show, we have the Gullible Brothers, live via satellite from the east coast of Antarctica. Hello, boys, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm Gary Gullible. This is my younger brother, Justice Gullible. Thanks for having us on the show.
You bet. What actually do you have available in the way of land?
We got beautiful home sites available, which ocean front once the ice melts a little bit. God, it's cold. And now we've got some beautiful farms and more inland as soon as we lose about 40 feet of this snow. Oh, Lord.
I'm also working hard to keep this planet clean. But man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms.
Well, boys, what's the weather like down there? Sounds cold.
Well, it's not too bad. 62 below, but at the moment wind chills is 100 below. But spirits are high. We've been told it's definitely going to rise in a few little while. There's records in 7 feet of snow and all. But Al Gore said it's going to be okay. Oh, Lord. Justice, run. And here comes a polar bear.
I'm also working hard just to keep this planet clean. But man-made global warming just don't make no sense to me. But if you insist on buying into this media false alarm, I know a couple of guys who wheel and deal in frozen farms.
Well, we'd just like to thank the Gullibles for joining us today. Barry Gullible, any last words for those who may be looking to relocate once the rest of the world floods? Oh, my goodness. Okay, Justice, how about you?
I can't feel my feet.
That's Ray Stevens. He's just a great humorist, and does he ever nail the global warming thing right on the money? Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on Light Resistance Radio. Gonna take a little bit of a change of pace here and play a little bit of Hank Jr. Hank Williams Jr., of course, the very talented son of the late Hank Williams Sr. Started off singing his father's songs to very popular demand, but gradually developed his own hard-hitting country rock style. This is Hank Williams Jr., and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio.
Man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and the country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't farm us out and you can't make us run. Those wooden old boys raised on shotguns. can run a trot line and a country boy can survive.
Country folks can survive.
I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. Grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. Spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Thank you.
Side. Me back with the game tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.